All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, we've left the upper room here now. Maybe it'd be a good idea just to put our map up here again. We're going to be on a path here just to kind of give an overview all the way to the cross. He's going to end up way over there. We're here now. The upper room, we're going to say it was probably down here, a little under the temple here. They go on the Kidron Valley. They're going to go up to the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus is going to pray. And then he's going to be taken, betrayed there by Judas. And they're going to he's going to come with the mob. They're going to take him to Annas, which was the previous high priest, I guess the retired high priest. He's going to talk to him first and then send him to his son-in-law, who's the current high priest, whose name is Caiaphas. Caiaphas is then, the Jews are going to then appeal to have Jesus put to death. So Caiaphas is going to send him over to number three over there and go to Pilate. Pilate isn't going to find anything wrong, anything to accuse him, but he hears he's from Galilee, so he sends Jesus over to the ruler of Galilee, who happens to be in Jerusalem at this time, Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas doesn't find anything, and he sends him back to Pilate without a charge against him. Pilate will then send him to the cross. Number six over there. So that's the path we're taking. That's the path we're going on through here. So now we've left the room. He's going to come up in the Kidron Valley and up a little ways into the Garden of Gethsemane and up on the Mount of Olives. And that's where we're going to next. So let's just kind of restart our mental thinking here with where we've come so far. It's important to realize we've had these suppers, the Passover supper. Now Jesus has expanded that to that Last Supper, whereby he's going to fulfill everything those lambs and those firstborn sons and the lambs that they transferred the house's sins onto for the last 1,500 years, going back to the Exodus, now is going to be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. He's going to be what all those other firstborn sons who represented their household couldn't do, and they put those sins on those lambs, and what those lambs couldn't do, the Lord Jesus Christ, Israel's ultimate firstborn son, is going to do. He's going to be the offerer, and he's going to be the sacrifice, and he's going to go to that cross. And he's been telling his disciples about that the whole time. We could even go back to Matthew 16, where we went last week. But really, even before that, he'd been giving hints and explanations of what was coming ahead. So instead of going to the cross, to the altar of faith, in accord with Psalm 118, understanding that God would raise him from the dead, going like Abraham. Abraham knew, and we're actually going to see more Abraham of the Abraham story in Gethsemane here. So keep that, bring that back to your mind, the sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham sacrificing his only begotten son. God the Father is now going to sacrifice his only begotten son. That was a picture of what's going to happen on this cross. Nobody is really putting Jesus to death here. Jesus is going to that cross on his own. And we've saw that a couple different ways. One word, and he blew away the mob, which probably included Roman soldiers and the police from the temple, trained guards. And then in John, he talks about the fact that he could call down, or in Matthew, he talks about the fact he could call down legion of angels. And so nobody's taking him he has to go to that cross. He said at the beginning of Matthew 26, in 2 days, I'm going to be on that cross. And he wants his disciples to go with him. A big point in chapter 26, when you look at the whole book, there's more talk about Jesus being together with his disciples than any place else in the book. He wants to eat the Passover. He wants to do the Last Supper with them. He wants to go with them. He wants them to watch and pray with them in the garden. He wants them to be with him. But they are going to leave him. And that's where we pick it up. They're going to fall asleep in the garden. They're going to be offended. They're going to fall asleep in the garden. Then they're going to run away from Christ at his betrayal and leaving him not then to carry it out all by himself. instead of being hoisted on their shoulders and while singing Psalm 118 and victoriously going to that cross in faith, they're going to desert him. He's going to have to go in the hands of his enemies, and he's going to have to go all alone. And we're going to see that in the prayer here as well. So they refuse to trust in God and his word. They refuse, and I just listed out here some of the ways, and that will introduce us into the passage here. Last week we looked at Matthew 16. He told them explicitly, and he does it several times after Matthew 16, I am going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer at the hands of the religious leaders there, and then I'm going to go to the cross, and then I'm going to rise again in the third day. And what does Peter say? No way, Lord, not while I'm on duty, not going to happen. And he did that because, not because God the Father was hiding this truth from him, keeping it from him, making it so he couldn't have known. It was a plain statement of his death and resurrection. Some people did know. You read about Mary and Martha in John 11 or 12 there. Mary and Martha got it. They understood he was going to that cross and he's going to rise again on the third day. They understood it. The disciples, though, have another plan. It tells us explicitly in Matthew 16 why Peter and the disciples didn't receive his truth about his death and resurrection. And it says there explicitly, it says, because they were, savoring the things of men, not the things of God. They took God's things. Jesus told them explicitly, a three-year-old could understand it. I have to go and suffer and die and be raised again. And he says, no way. It's not because it was hid from them supernaturally in some way. It's because they didn't like that plan. They didn't want that plan. They wanted a Messiah who would be the come in power and glory and destroy the Gentiles. And that's going to happen, but that's not till the second coming. The first coming, he comes in humbly and not in power, but in suffering. And they didn't like that plan, so they covered up his plan with their plan. And therefore, they didn't know these things. And we're going to see a couple more examples of this as we go through here. Psalm 118, we spent some time on that. They refused to follow Psalm 118 in faith. And now, let's pick it up here in verse 31 and see a couple other instances. If you want to know why the disciples didn't understand about Jesus' death and resurrection, he's going to give you two more examples that are just as plain right here. So let's look at Matthew 26, verse 31. Then saith Jesus unto them. So now they've sung the hymn, they're heading out of the Last Supper, and Jesus is now going to tell them he realizes they're not going to go with him. They realize they had their chance, and they're not receiving his truth about his death and resurrection. They're not going to go with him. So now, instead of freely and willfully following Psalm 118 in faith, fulfilling Psalm 118 in faith. Now he's going to explain to them, because they're still in unbelief and are rejecting the truth about his death and resurrection, they are going to unwillingly fulfill Zechariah 7:9. And that's what we read here. Matthew 26:31. Then said Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended at me. All ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd. And I think I misquoted the verse there. It's Zechariah 13:7. I will smite the shepherd and sheep of the flock, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. But after I am risen again, see, he never talks about his smiting, his death on that cross, without also adding on, I'm going to be raised again on the third day. See, this isn't like any other human death. This isn't your typical human death where then you're dead and you're buried and that's the end of the story, at least from the earthly standpoint. He's going to go to his death and he's going to be raised again. And so it's a totally different kind of death. It's not a death of despair and defeat. It was to the 11 here because they were rejecting what he was doing. It's a cross that is going to result in hope, full of hope and victory. And they're missing that. And you're going to see what happens in rejecting that truth. There's going to be a whole trail of events here. Go starting with the garden that's going to take place. And let's see the first one here. So he says, all of them are going to be offended because of me this night. And it's a pretty simple statement, right? All are going to be offended. You could tell it to a three-year-old and he'd get it in an instant. There's nothing difficult about this statement. It's plain up front, no problem. But look at Peter's response. Verse 33, but Peter answered and said unto him, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. Now, Jesus just told him he was going to be offended that night. And Peter says, no, I'm not. He's going to go now and say even more than that, Jesus, but that, you want to know why he didn't know about the death and resurrection of Christ? It's not because God was hiding it from him or anything like that. It's because he rejected it, just like he's rejecting this truth. Jesus just told him the plainest language you could imagine, you're going to be offended by me tonight. Peter says, no, I'm not. He's not listening to Jesus. He's not listening yet. He's not believing his words. He's believing in himself. He's believing in his own abilities. And he's doing what we do every second of every day. He's trying to get God involved in his plans. And God's not going to do it. God wants, and Jesus wants, to include Peter in his plans. Totally different there. One is a religious system, and one's a biblical truth. It's what we do every single minute of every day. How many times do we know we've been told what God is doing today, and we're trying to get him to do something else? For instance, spiritual blessings. We have all spiritual blessings in heavenly places. So what do we spend all our time in prayer trying to get God to do? Give us physical blessings. He's not giving physical blessings. He's giving spiritual blessings. We throw away one. We replace it with the other. It's the same thing that Peter and the 12 are doing here. Well, Peter and the 11 at this time. They're throwing away God's plan and replacing it with their own. And don't look down on Peter. It's what we do every single moment of every day. We know the things God's doing today, and we throw them away because we want him. We think religion tells us from the very first day we're born, you get saved so that you can get God involved in your things. That's the way most of historical Christianity looks at it. That's not what God and the Bible say. God says, no, I didn't save you so I can get involved in your things. I saved you so I could involve you in my things. And there's a night and day difference there. That is totally different. That's upside down, turns everything inside out. It's a totally different approach. God has saved us. I talked to someone a couple of years ago, and she said she got saved and started going to church all the time because then she could get God to heal her husband. Well, you see, that's what you're taught in historic Christianity, that getting saved is your way to get God to do what you want. But no, that's not what biblical Christianity is. Biblical Christianity is the fact that God has saved you, so now he can involve you in his things. Totally different. Throw away, we're reading about this in Romans on Thursdays, you got to throw away the world's view, replace it with God's view. And your flesh isn't going to like it. No more than Peter's flesh was liking it here. He didn't want to go with a Messiah who's going to a Roman cross and suffer and be put to death. He wanted to go with a Messiah with a sword in his hand, wiping out the Gentiles and all the enemies. And he just refuses to receive that truth. And don't, as I said earlier, don't look down on them. It's what we do every day. We're told what God's doing today in this dispensation of grace, in his mystery program. We're told the important things that are important to God today. And we say, well, those aren't all that important to me. God, I need you to do this and this and this. And then we wonder why it doesn't happen. So let's look at this example again. Jesus tells them, simple language, you're going to be offended by me tonight. Peter says, no, I'm not. He's not listening. He hears the words, but he's not receiving them. Look, and so Jesus is going to drive home his point again. Look at verse 34. Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice, three times. That's a pretty simple statement, too. You could go to a three-year-old and tell them that. What's Peter say? Verse 35. Peter said unto him, though I should die with thee, yet I will not deny thee. Likewise also said all the disciples. They're not receiving. It's not that they're somehow hidden from them, these truths. They're rejecting them. It said in Matthew 16, it's the key to the whole thing. They're savoring the things of men rather than the things of God. And that's going to be end up with them falling into temptation. And it's going to, instead of praying in the garden, they're going to fall asleep. And let's go on to that. So he tells them three times. He's going to deny them three times. They deny it. They're not receiving Jesus' word. And so they fall into, right here what you have is they fall into spiritual slumber that's going to lead to physical slumber in that garden. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. Instead of trusting in Jesus, believing what he said, they underestimated the power of their own sinful flesh and the sifting program of Satan that lie ahead for them. And we'll look in Luke 22 in a second. Jesus is going to end here by saying the spirit is willing to be faithful, but the flesh is weak. Let's go over to Luke 22 and just see what he says here. Luke 22, verse 31. Luke 22, verse 31. This is the same thing. He's telling him Peter's going to, predicts Peter's denials. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. And we've talked about this earlier in Matthew, this whole, especially during that tribulation period, beginning here in the days of Jesus, and then again in that intensified in that tribulation period, the whole believing remnant is going to be sifted. He's going to try and destroy them. He's going to try and get rid of them. If he can get rid of that believing remnant, Satan can get rid of that believing remnant, then there will be nothing to recreate the nation of Israel out of, and God will have failed. That's his plan of attack. He's going to try and sift them. He's going to try and remove them from the scene. He has a policy of evil against Peter here at this time, the 11 at that time, going on into Pentecost and early Acts, and especially in that tribulation, he's going to try to destroy that believing remnant before Jesus can turn it into his new nation of Israel. And he has a sifting program. They should have known about this. They should have had absolutely no problem understanding this because, let's go back to, last week I said Matthew 16 seemed like ancient history. I'm going all the way back here to Matthew 5. So this might be, I don't know, what's older than ancient history, primordial history or something. Go back to chapter 5. Look what he's telling them all the way back in chapter 5 to this believing remnant. This is the Beatitudes, and look what he's already at this point warning them about. Look at Matthew 5, verse 10. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. On the way back to Matthew 26, stop at Matthew 10. And we see he's sending out the 12, and he's going to warn them again. Matthew 10, Look at, oh, we'll just pick it up in verse 16. Behold, I send you as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And of course, it's the serpent that's going to be attacking them. Know the wiles of the serpent. Be understand his plan of attack. What it is we just read in Luke. He says, hey, Peter, you don't understand. Satan wants to sift you. He wants you. He wants to get his claws in you. Same thing he's saying here. Peter didn't know. He wasn't listening to Jesus' words. He wasn't receiving them, so he didn't know about the wiles of the serpent. Be as harmless as doves, but beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues, and you shall be brought before the governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. And he goes on to describe some other things. They should have known about all this. They should have known, but they're rejecting Jesus' his words, his explanation. And so they're not aware of his sifting program. They're not aware of the weakness of their own flesh. What they needed to do is rely on God's power and the truth of his word. And now as they enter this spiritual slumber, soon as you reject God's word, you enter into spiritual slumber. Whether it's in the dispensation of the law or dispensation of grace or any other dispensation, there's an interdispensational truth. Anytime you cover up God's word with your own word or the word of the world or the word, human words, human plans, human viewpoint, your own viewpoint, and you bury away God's, it's going to become hid to you. And these basic statements he's given to Peter, by the end of the night, you're going to be offended. No, I'm not, Lord. By the end of the night, you're going to deny me three times. No, I'm not. And you know what's going to happen? We'll see this as we go through here. But Peter is going to, guess what? He's going to forget about that. He's going to forget. It's going to be, let's say, hidden from him until there's going to come one point when all of a sudden, he's going to remember what Jesus said. Before that, it's like he hears it and he buries it. No, I'm not. It's not my plan, Lord. I'm not going to give in to that. And he forgets it. It becomes buried. He covers it up. It's hid from him until an incident that happens a little later. And we'll look forward to reading that. And he's going to then wake up. But now he's going to enter spiritual slumber along with all the others. Look what it says at the end of verse 35. Likewise also said all the disciples. So spiritual slumber is going to lead to that physical slumber in the garden. Rejecting God and his word, they didn't have anything to talk about to God. So they fell asleep. They fell asleep. And why don't we go ahead and just read through here. We're going to do this, and we're going to first go through it and look at what the disciples are doing, and then we'll kind of go back again and look at Jesus' prayer and what Jesus is doing. But let's go ahead and just read through the account here. Verse 36, then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane, and said unto his disciples, sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. So he goes up into the hills a little bit, the mountain a little bit, and he tells now 8 of the 11, because remember Judas is out of the picture, so we're down to 11, and he leaves 8. He tells them to stay. Does that sound like anything? Do you remember from Genesis 22, what did Abraham do when he was offering up Isaac? He told the men, wait down here. We're going to go up and worship, and then we'll come back. Because Abraham knew if Isaac was put to death, God would raise him from the dead. So he'll be back with Isaac. No problem. And he leaves him, Jesus, now following those steps. Of course, here, Jesus is the offerer and the offering, unlike with Abraham. But he's going to leave the men at the base. He's going to take 3 with him. Let's read about that, verse 37. And he took with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, James and John, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then said he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. Notice again, all the together with. Look at verse 36. Then cometh Jesus with, together with them. And he took Peter and James and John, and he took them with him, verse 37. Verse 38, and he wants them to watch with me. He wants to be with his disciples, but his disciples have already left him in rejecting his word in the previous verses. And we'll see that as we go through here. So we'll look at what Jesus' sorrow about and what his prayer when our next loop through here. But let's just follow through the disciples. Verse 39. And so Jesus went a little farther. Other places, I think it says a stone's throw, and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." And he cometh unto the disciples and findeth them asleep, and said unto Peter, "What, could you not watch?" Here we have it again. "Could you not watch with me for 1 hour?" They're already leaving him. The spiritual slumber and rejecting his word about their death, his death and resurrection, rejecting Psalm 818, rejecting the offensiveness that they're going to experience, rejecting his words about the denial. They've entered a spiritual slumber, and now they don't have anything to talk to God about, so they fall asleep. The idea here of watch isn't a watch, a guard to ward off someone. The idea is watch so you can stay awake and pray with me. Now look what Jesus says next, verse 41. "Watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation." That's going to be the key. We're going to see this. Jesus is going to watch and pray, and his ending is going to be much different than the disciples who don't watch and pray, and they're going to fall into temptation. They're going to be taken into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Verse 42. "He went away again the second time and prayed, saying, O my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy." And we'll see why they were sorrowful, why they were heavy. They're not sorrowful and heavy the same reason Jesus is sorrowful and heavy. So we'll take a look at that when we come back around. But here we just want to notice that they've entered the spiritual sleep, at least to physical sleep. They've already deserted the Lord. They're there physically, but spiritually and mentally, they're gone. They've already left him. And in a few verses, look down at the end of verse 56, "Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." They're all going to be off the scene shortly. They're all going to forsake him. And it's already really happened at this point. They go to sleep. They won't be with Christ. They refuse to be with Christ. And they're going to flee. They're going to leave him all alone. The disciples had much to pray about if they believed. They could have been praying about, Jesus just told them they're going to be offended. Maybe that had been a good thing to pray to the Father about. Remove this temptation of offending. Remove this temptation of denying. They could have been praying about if they received Christ's words about his death and resurrection, and it wasn't a despair and a defeat. It was full of hope and victory. It was the fulfillment of all scriptures. If they had looked at it the way Jesus looked at it, they could have been talking to the Father about that. They had a million things. All the things Jesus has been talking about going all the way back to that Sermon on the Mountain before, they could have been talking to the Father about all that. But they didn't like the Father's plan. That's the problem. Same reason we don't know what to pray about, or we don't like to pray to God, because we don't like the Father's plan. We don't want to do it his way. We want him to do it our way. And Peter is the same thing that we do, as I said at the beginning, over and over again. They had tons to pray about if they were in accord with Jesus and God's plan. But in rejecting Jesus' words and God's plan, they didn't have anything to talk about. If you replace God's things with your own things, or the world's things, then you won't have anything to talk to God about, so you'll either go to sleep like they did. If you're honest, you'll just go to sleep. if you want to play religious games, then you'll go and you'll talk about God about the things you want God to do. Instead of talking to him about the things God wants you to do, you'll talk to him about what you want him to do. As though you or any of us are going to be able to get the God and creator of the universe, like a genie in a bottle or something like that, he can just get him to do what we want. He's not going to do our plan. I hate to break it to everyone. We're not the center of the universe. God is. And he didn't save us so we could get him involved in our things. He saved us so he could use us now in his things. And the goal of the Christian life and the life in Israel's prophetic program as well was to get in line with what God's accomplishing in that program. But we don't like that. So we do other things. And then you can engage. You either fall asleep and we'll stop praying, or you'll go into religious prayer and you'll just do your own little thing. You'll call it prayer, but it's really nothing but a monologue with yourself. God's not going to change his plan and purpose. What he's accomplishing today or at the time in Israel's prophetic program, he's getting you involved in his plan, not him involved in your plans. And it's a total, as I said before, night and day difference. If they had embraced what Jesus was telling was going on, and his death and resurrection was the fulfillment of everything, they would have seen it not as full of despair, but full of hope, and not as a certain defeat, but a certain victory. And they would have gone and stayed with him. And they would have been there and participated in it, had the opportunity to participate in it. Instead, having rejected God's plan, they looked at it and thought everything was falling apart. When in fact, in God's plan, everything is coming together. They thought the seams were all breaking. And God, Jesus was trying to tell them, no, the seams are all being sewn together. Everything's coming to fulfillment here. Get in line with God and Jesus, God's plan and Jesus' words, and they would have viewed that they would have had something to talk to God about. They would have had an infinite number of things to talk to God about. That's why I'm always surprised when I share grace and the infinite spiritual blessings in heavenly places, all that Christ has done with us today in this dispensation of grace. Romans 1 to 11, Ephesians 1 to 3 for starters, the infinite number, the trillions and trillions of blessings and wonderful and what God's doing today, where we are in this world. And then people tell me they don't have anything to pray about. And I'm just like, they're doing the same thing Peter's doing here. It's not that they don't have anything to pray about. They just don't want to pray about the things God wants to talk about. So they don't have anything to pray about. We need to get in line, whether it's in Israel's prophetic program with Peter and the 11, or with us in the dispensation of grace. It's prioritizing the things of God. And then what is important to God is important to us. You have an infinite number of things to pray to God about. It might not be what your flesh wants to talk about, because your flesh thinks it can get God to do what it wants. Your flesh thinks God is there to do all is whatever he wants him to do. God says, no, I saved you. Remember in the last half of Romans 1, he says, I can't use fallen humanity. I have to separate myself from it. I have to hand them over. I can't use them anymore. And so Romans tells you how he goes to make fallen humanity part of a new creation that he can use. Not so that he can get involved in our things, but so that we can get involved in his things. And if his things aren't important enough to you, you might know them intellectually, you might know them from an educational standpoint or curriculum or whatever people call it, but if you don't really value them, you're not going to have anything to talk to God about. And then you're going to spend your time just having a monologue with yourself. This is what Peter's doing here. I'll never do that, Lord. And he's going to go and do everything he said he didn't do, wouldn't do. And if you replace God's things with your own things, you won't have anything to talk to God about, so you'll either go to sleep like the disciples or engage in pretend religious prayer, which is really just a monologue with yourself. This is as true in God's prophetic program as it is today in the mystery program, dispensation of grace. The rest of this account now is going to be the difference between the faithful response of Jesus and the unfaithful response of Peter and the disciples. That's what's going to play out now as you see these two situations come into play. They not only didn't understand the weakness of their own flesh, they also didn't understand the satanic warfare that was about to be unleashed upon them. Satan desired to sift them. That's how Jesus sums it up in Luke 22. We already looked at that, so we won't turn there again. But that kind of summarizes, brings us where we are with them now. They've rejected Jesus' words in a whole variety of different ways. They don't want a Messiah that's going to suffer at the hands of the religious leaders and be put on a Roman cross. They wanted a Messiah in their own way. They wanted one who'd come in power and glory and destroy the Gentiles. So they didn't, it was hidden from them. They didn't know it. They buried it under their own preconceived notions and what they wanted. And they didn't have anything to pray about. And they fall asleep. Let's finish reading in verse 44 here. And he left them and went away saying again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. Then cometh he to the disciples, this is the third time now, and saith unto them, sleep on. He knows they're gone. They've already left him. They've already departed. They entered slumberous, spiritual slumber when they left his words. They entered into mental, emotional anguish because they rejected his words, because they viewed it now, everything falling apart, everything falling. See, in Peter and the 11's plan, everything was falling apart. But in Jesus and in God's plan, everything is coming together. In Peter and the 11's plan, there's only despair. In God and Jesus' plan, it's full of hope. In Peter and the 11's plan, all they saw was a defeat. In God and Jesus' plan, there was only victory. He's going to be raised again on the third day, and he's going to deal with sin and Satan on that cross and be raised again on the third day. And so they were sorrowful because they thought everything was coming apart. That's not why Jesus is sorrowful. And we'll go back now and look at his part of this. If the 11 at this point were operating in faith, they would have stayed there, watched with Jesus, watched in the sense of staying awake so they too could pray. Pray so that they, and they had all kinds of things. They could pray, not enter into temptation. I guess we should look at that because it's brought out here, verse 41, so that you not enter into temptation. Hopefully everyone remembers, even though Matthew 6 was ancient, even more ancient history. Go back to Matthew 6 and remember what's traditionally called that Lord's Prayer. Look at Matthew 6, verse 10. Matthew 6, verse 10. Well, I guess we'll begin at verse 9. Matthew 6, verse 9. After this manner, therefore, pray ye, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. For Peter and the 11, they thought God's will was falling apart. For God and Jesus, his will is coming to earth. This cross is what's going to accomplish all this that they're supposed to be praying about. They have plenty to pray about. Here's something they could have been praying. Through that cross, what happens, God's heavenly kingdom is going to come to the earth. Thy kingdom come, verse 10, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Now look at verse 13. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. If they were listening to Jesus, they'd be praying that prayer. they'd be seeing the power and the glories coming after the cross. The cross is going to be what makes the power and the glory possible. It's going to be what makes everything possible. It's going to be the fulfillment of everything. And they wouldn't be sorrowful because they were despairing and defeated. They'd be sorrowful because of what lay ahead for Jesus in that cup of wrath. And let's go ahead and look. Look at what he says here with regard to that. So they weren't heeding Jesus' words. They're going to faint with faithfulness. If you look over at Luke 18:1, well, let's go ahead and look there just to tie that together. Luke 18:1. This is the parable of the unjust judge. We're not going to even look at the parable, but I just look how he introduces this parable. Luke 18, verse 1. And he spoke a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. The tie there, prayer and not fainting. They aren't going to pray and they're going to faint. They're going to despair. Instead of believing Jesus, they're going to despair. They're going to think everything's falling apart. There's apparent failure in Jesus and his whole mission. It was all falling apart. When in fact, if they were listening to Jesus, they'd see, no, everything's congealing together. Everything is going to be fulfilled. Everything. So now let's compare this to the faithful Jesus. Compare this to Jesus' response. Now let's pick it up again, go back to the beginning of this, and we'll be closing with this. Verse 38. He goes up to the, takes Peter, James, and John with him. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. So he's as exceeding sorrowful. But why is he sorrowful? Let's read his prayer. And he went a little further away. Another account says a stone's throw, and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. He's not not wanting to go to the cross. He's not talking about his death on the cross. He's been arranging for that going all the way back to the beginning. That's the whole reason he came, was to go to that cross. What he's asking for here is the removal of the cup. Now, what's the cup? That's that cup of wrath. That's the cup associated with what's going to happen on that cross. The cup of the wrath of God. Go back to Leviticus 26. Keep your finger in Matthew 26. But look at all that he's going to take onto himself on that cross. You see this wrath concept. Remember those courses of punishment? Remember there's five courses of punishment brought on, and it was meant to chastise them, to discipline them, to bring them back to himself. But every course of punishment just sent them, made them more rebellious. And he has one course of punishment, second course, third, fourth, fifth. We're in the fifth course of punishment now in the gospel account. And he's got all this wrath. Remember, we had the parable, the 10,000 talents of debt, the national debt of Israel, all that sin, all that rebellion, all that chastisement, all that punishment placed on that comes through, that's been accruing in their program because of their unbelief and rebellion and sin. And look what God says here. At the very beginning of their history, he says, oh, let's just pick up. These are the courses of punishment. Leviticus 26, verse 17. He's going to start with, I will set my face against them. Leviticus 26, 17. And then look down at verse 18. And if they will not yet for all this hearken to me, then I will punish them seven times more. Go down to verse 21. If you walk contrary unto me after the second chastisement and not hearken unto me, I will bring seven times more. And then look at verse 23. And if you will not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk contrary to me, then I will walk contrary to you and punish you yet seven times for your sin. And now go down to verse 27, the fifth course of punishment. And if ye will not for all this hearken unto me, but walk contrary unto me, then I will walk contrary unto you in fury. All those chastisements, all those courses of punishment, cycles of just building the national debt more and more and more in their rebelliousness and sinfulness. And Christ is going to go to that cross and he's going to take it all onto himself. All that chastisement, all that wrath. And you know what it's going to culminate in? It's going to culminate in this cup of wrath is going to culminate in, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? God himself is going to hide his face from the Son on that cross. God the Holy Spirit, God the Father is going to turn away, hide his face from the Son. He's going to have to go, and he's not just going to be all alone because his disciples refused to go to him. He's going to be all alone on that cross, bearing all the sin of Israel, is what we're told about in the gospel accounts. Of course, Paul explains that he also took on all the sin of the whole world onto himself. The Gospels are dying for his friends, so it's the nation of Israel, that believing remnant. He takes it all onto himself. That 10,000 talents of debt, the millions and trillions of dollars of debt built up that the nation could never escape on its own, he takes it all onto himself, and it culminates in, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's the cup he has ahead of him. That's the cup of the Last Supper. That's most certainly not the cup we are blessed. We have our fellowship and blessing today. We read in 1 Corinthians 10, he has the cup of wrath. And he says, if that could be taken away, O Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou will. So now he, in faithful prayer, he's going to be ministered to. And I think it's good to maybe break in at this point and see what happens according to what Luke says. Because there's an interesting character that comes on the scene. Go to Luke 22. Luke 22. Luke 22, verse 43. Now remember, we have the disciples who aren't listening to Jesus, have rejected God's plan, or we've tried to replace it with their own plan, and now it's all fallen apart for them. So they're despairing, they've spiritually slumbered, and they've fallen into physical slumber. They've already left Jesus, and they're in mental and emotional anguish because they think everything's fallen apart. And exhausted from that, but now look what that's how the Gethsemane account ends for the disciples. But look how it ends for Jesus. Look at Luke 22. Jesus watched and prayed, and that he might be delivered from temptation. And let's see if it worked. Look at verse. Oh, I guess let's begin at verse 40, since that brings up the praying and the temptation. Luke 22, verse 40, and when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast and kneeled down and prayed. He's going to do what he told them. What they aren't going to do, he's going to do, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup of wrath that's going to culminate in God forsaking God from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine will. And look at verse 43. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. This isn't the first time we find angels strengthening Jesus, right? Remember the first time? Well, not even the first time, because earlier in the birth accounts, I guess it could be thought of indirectly, but go back to Matthew 4 at the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. Remember when he's tempted, he doesn't eat anything for 40 days and 40 nights, and the tempter comes and tempts him. What was the tempter trying to do? What was Satan trying to do, the adversary? He's trying to do what Peter and the 11 are trying to get Jesus to do. He's trying to get Jesus to get the world, to get his kingdom on earth in some way that doesn't involve the cross. Peter is substituting the wisdom of the world. Who's the ruler of the world? Satan. he's trying to get him to do it that way. What does Jesus say? We can look at this too in chapter 16. I don't think we read this far, but what does Jesus say to Peter? Peter rebukes him. You're not going to that cross. Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. And it all goes back to this. Here we have Satan tempting him in the wilderness here. We're not going to read through the whole account, but look how it ends. He's trying to get Jesus. He says, if you fall down and worship me, you can just have the kingdom. You can have the world. You can have all the nations of the earth. You don't need to go to that cross. There's another way. You don't have to do it the Father's way. You can do it my way. Peter's saying the same thing. You don't have to do it the Father's way. You can do it my way. Satan, get thee behind me. And Satan does that for these temptations here, but look how it ends. Well, I guess let's begin at verse 10. Then Jesus said unto him, get thee hence, Satan. He told Peter, get thee behind me, Satan. For it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Then the devil leaveth him, and behold, angels came and ministered unto him. Now, no doubt, they ministered and strengthened him. And I imagine one of the primary ways would be physically, because he hasn't eaten for 40 days and 40 nights. We know in our account in Matthew 26, probably physical hunger wasn't his biggest problem, because he just had two big dinners, right? The Passover supper and the Last Supper. So what was the angel strengthening? And so I just came up with some ideas based on other things said in the scriptures, just to kind of think, here you have Jesus doing what he told the disciples to do, but they refused. They enter spiritual slumber, they fall asleep, and they're going to fall into temptation. He goes off and watches and prays, and he's strengthened. He's going to end up stronger than he was before. When he leaves Gethsemane, it's like, everyone out of the way. I'm setting my face like a flint. We're going to the cross. He's strengthened. What might this angel have been strengthening with? I'm kind of just coming up with things based on other things said in the gospel. In faithful prayer, he was ministered by an angel, strengthening spiritually, emotionally, mentally, all the things the disciples could have had if they listened to Jesus. And maybe he was reminding him. And we can look up some of these passages. Remember, after the resurrection, Jesus says, now everything has been fulfilled. He says, everything in the law and the prophets and the Psalms, everything's been fulfilled. Maybe he was strengthening his inner man by assuring him of the Father's will and looking toward the joy that was set before him. Let's look at this, because this is a pretty amazing verse. Go to Hebrews. Keep your finger in Matthew 26. Go to Hebrews. Hebrews 12, verse 2. Hebrews 12, verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy... See, now that doesn't sound much like what Peter and the 11 are experiencing. The joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Maybe that angel was reminding him about what's the resurrection, what all that cross is going to accomplish in the resurrection, and it's going to place him above all other things. Maybe he's reminding him of some things like that. Go to John 17. Look what he might be reminding Jesus about, strengthening him. By John 17, what he has to look forward to after the cross. John 17, look at verse 5. John 17, verse 5. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. After that cross and the resurrection, he's going to return to the glory. He had the eternal glory as God the Son, together with the Father. Maybe the angel is strengthening, reminding him of that. Go to the last verses of Matthew, the last couple verses of Matthew here. Maybe he's reminding of the fact, verse 18, Matthew 28, verse 18. And Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, all power... This is after the resurrection. All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Maybe the angels remind him that, strengthening him with that. All these things, he's strengthening and building him up. And notice now with that angel that we don't see in Matthew, but we told about in Luke. Now look how his prayer changes. Let's look a little bit at how his prayer changes. Look at verse 11. Matthew 26, I'm in 27, so that won't work. Look at verse 40. So he comes to the disciples again, finds them asleep. You couldn't watch with me for 1 hour. This is Matthew 26, 41. Watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Verse 42, he went away again the second time and prayed, saying, O my Father, if this cup may not pass... Remember the first time he said that it may pass, if it may pass. Now something has happened between the first prayer and the second prayer because now he knows it can't pass. It's the Father's plan. He wanted to verify the Father's plan. He goes and prays with the Father's plan. The angel comes and ministers to him. And now he prays, I know the cup can't pass. And he says, if this cup may not pass, he knows, except I drink of it, thy will be done. And he came and found them asleep again. It progresses through here. That first prayer, he gets strengthened by the angel. The angel, no doubt, was reminding him of all the things that lay ahead for him, the benefits that he would accrue for Israel and the world, for himself as he goes through that cross and that resurrection, his exaltation above all our things, receiving all power in heaven and earth, saving the nation of Israel, fulfilling all the scriptures, bringing about the fulfillment of all his covenants, the Davidic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the new covenant, creating a new nation and establishing God's glory on earth. And he was strengthened. And now he comes and prays a second time and he says, I know now the cup can't be passed. Thy will be done, not my will be done. And he goes a third time. And he goes a third time to pray. And he says, and he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same things. He's resolved now. The cup can't pass. He's got to drink of that cup. And he's going to go to that cross. He's strengthened now. With a word, he's going to blow back the mob. In an instant, he could have called down 12 legions of angels. He's set to go. He doesn't do any of that. He doesn't destroy them, and he doesn't call down angels. He goes to that cross. The disciples are going to scatter, and he's going to go to that cross all alone at the hands of his enemies. And with all set before him, with the joy set before him, he's going to go and complete the work and the plan and the will of the Father.